and welcome to Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Dr. Arnold Baskies is back, surgeon, chair of the Global Cancer Control Advisory Council, and past chairman of the National Board of Directors for the American Cancer Society. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
I am good. Last time we spoke, we were talking about the American Cancer Society and its concerns during this COVID period. And before we're going to jump back into that and resume that conversation, but first, do you want to give us the mission statement and what the American Cancer Society is all about?
Well, the American Cancer Society is the oldest cancer fighting organization in the world, including the United States, of course. And our mission is really simple. The American Cancer Society's mission is to save lives, celebrate lives, and lead the fight for a world without cancer. And we've been very successful at doing that. Of course, we could always enjoy more success, but keep in mind that we've seen a 26% decline in deaths over the last 25 years, and that's something that we really should celebrate. Our job isn't finished, and in fact, it's, as you hinted, it's been stymied by COVID, but nevertheless, cancer doesn't stop, COVID will. And so we are all in terms of fighting this disease. And we're an equal opportunity kind of organization with over 2 million volunteers. And we don't discriminate against any particular cancer. We want to battle all of the cancers that are out there. So we're kind of the mother of all cancer fighting operations. There were some disease organizations that are devoted to just stopping one particular cancer. But we know from all of the things that we've learned is that cancers have crossovers. In other words, if you can combat successfully one cancer, you can have tremendous success having learned what works in that cancer to fight others. So we fight all the cancers, all the way from pediatric cancers, all the way to cancers that affect older adults. So we're in there for the fight, and we've been doing a job that I think is commendable over the last over 100 years.
We were talking about your concerns that people were delaying screenings and were not getting treatments, weren't going to see their doctors because of fear of the COVID virus. Now, is that still the case? And is that going to impact your survival rates in the coming years?
Well, the truth of the matter is, Laura, that it has impacted tremendously people going for screenings and delaying their screenings when it should be done. And this has been the case for all adult cancers as well as for children's cancers. And so we are very concerned about that. And one of the other things we're concerned about in terms of we're not just concerned about the delays in screenings. We're also concerned about the effect that COVID has had on cancer research. It takes about 10 years for a discovery that's made in a laboratory to make it to a treatment. And so think about this, over 200,000 studies, cancer fighting studies, trials have been impacted, delayed, or discontinued because of COVID. And that means that 200,000 potential breakthroughs have been delayed because of COVID. And if it takes 1 year, if it takes 10 years for a discovery in the lab to make it to a human being, just think about the impact that COVID has had in just 1 year in terms of cancer fighting discoveries as well as screenings. So it's a double whammy, if you will. COVID has not only impacted screenings, but it's also impacted the breakthroughs that we need on a daily basis to fight this disease. So, yes, we are very concerned about that, and we're hoping that with the vaccination process that's going on, we'll be able to get back in business in terms of that. But the ultimate screening process has been definitely impacted by COVID, and so we're very concerned that it's going to have an impact on survival and ultimately on discovering cancers at a, let's say, a more treatable stage of the disease.
Well, I was going to ask you about the research and many projects. They're obviously multi-year studies So studies that had begun were impacted by this, by the patients dropping out. Studies that were scheduled to begin didn't get started. And this will impact their research funding too, won't it?
Yes. All of those things are true and related. And so, yes, absolutely. We know I'm involved in three projects right now myself, just from a personal point of view. Two vaccination processes that we vaccines against cancer that we wanted to go into human trials, and one treatment for ovarian cancer that's been delayed. And so I can tell you from a personal basis, there are at least three potential breakthrough types of discoveries that have been directly impacted and delayed because we couldn't get reagents, we couldn't get materials that are necessary to do those studies in human beings. And so, yes, absolutely. And so what can we do about it? Well, let's get past COVID and back into the disease process treatments that we need to get into. And so progress has been stymied, yes, and treatments and trials have been delayed. And there was a study done early on at Yale. This goes back to last March, so you can now factor in what's happened. Last March, a study was done that showed over 200,000 trials had been impacted around the world, not just in the United States, by COVID last March. And so you can only imagine how many more studies either have been delayed or haven't even been submitted for funding because of COVID. So it is a tremendous problem, and one that we're going to pay the price for, I'm afraid, going forward.
The American Cancer Society, one of its missions, research, you have a different approach to how you research breakthroughs, how you fund programs.
That's absolutely correct. So the American Cancer Society has funded close to $5 billion worth of cancer research in the United States. We are the number one non-government funder of cancer research in this country, the first being the federal government. Number two, in terms of funding cancer research, is your American Cancer Society. So, and we have a very interesting way of funding research. We don't put our money into an institution. We don't put we don't fund studies because a particular institution has put in for a grant. What we have is an external group of researchers, of experts who come in on a yearly basis and review grants from every single institution in the country that wants a grant. And we fund the best and the brightest. And we are very proud of the fact that we fund young investigators. And in fact, if you look at the young investigators who we have funded 49 Nobel Prize winners before anybody even knew literally who they were. Their science was so innovative, we recognized it, we funded it. Had it not been for our backing of their research, potentially they would never have made the discoveries that they did later on in their careers. So we're very proud of the fact that we fund early research. We also fund people that have made tremendous advances, but our approach is find the best and the brightest, fund those people with their innovative ideas before anyone else has usually even recognized their work. And that's paid tremendous dividends for Americans and for people around the world, because had it not been for the fact that we funded those people at whatever institution they were at, they could be in Spokane, Washington, they could be in Chicago, they could be in Tallahassee, they could be in Philadelphia, they could be in New York, as long as their research is considered to be innovative and worthy by our external panel of experts, those people get funded. And so we're very proud of that fact. And no other group has funded 49 Nobel Prize winners like we have. So it's a tremendous accomplishment. We're very proud of it. And our way of funding things is unique in the sense that we don't go by funding for a region or for a particular state. We will fund anybody whose research is determined to be worthy. It doesn't matter whether they're in New Mexico or Maine. So yes, that is unique, and we've been doing that for at least close to 100 years. So that is a fact.
When you fund this research, it allows them to take it to a point where they can say, here's where it's headed, and go for those big grants, the big programs to allow them to go to the huge clinical research projects, et cetera, that we're more used to. Is research dollars, are they going to dry up after this year? Is it going to be harder to find funding? And were dollars lost because trials ended?
Well, if the truth be known, we have seen a tremendous drop in donations for cancer research. And that has been a particular problem that we're trying to get past this year. We depend on donations from everyone in the country, as well as from large donors. And we are a true grassroots organization. So the COVID has had a definite effect on the amount of dollars that are out there for research. And we're trying to battle that as hard as we can, and doing everything within our capabilities and powers, coming up with innovative new fundraising techniques, et cetera. But we do need all those dollars, because without them, there will be a decrease in the amount of research that's done. And we can't count on the breakthroughs that we've seen already that have made such a tremendous difference in the survival rates from all cancers. Look, in 1975, let me give you some really cogent statistics. In 1975, women with breast cancer had about a 75% chance of surviving their disease. That meant that 25% of people died from their breast cancer. Now the survival rates are over 90%, clocking in at around 93%. That didn't happen by accident. That happened because of research, better surgery, better techniques, better cancer chemotherapeutic options, and advances in radiation therapy. When you put all those things together, we've seen 25% more people are surviving breast cancer than did when I started my surgical training. So there's a very good example of the difference that research has made. And that research was also backed by dollars from people like you and me and everybody else who's contributed to any cancer-fighting organization, especially the American Cancer Society. So all of those successes are due to one thing. They're due to the fact that people have decided that they want to fight this disease, and they fight it best by making a contribution. And so, we've seen a definite decrease in people making those kinds of commitments dollar-wise. Over that one-year period of time, we saw a tremendous decline in people's contributions. We're hoping that with that as COVID numbers improve and as vaccinations get better and better in terms of numbers of people vaccinated, that people will see that cancer isn't going away, COVID will.
You just said the V word, vaccine. And as I recall, you worked in virology labs. In fact, I think you worked with Dr. Fauci. Cancer and viruses. We know, like, chickenpox can lead to shingles years, decades after you get infected. HPV linked to various cancers. Are you concerned about the later ramifications of a COVID infection? Do we have any idea what the long-term effects on cancer that may be? And then, you know, I'm going to ask about the quick, rapid response to COVID. Has that helped in vaccines for cancer research?
There's multiple questions wrapped up in your question.
I figured I'd just throw it out there and let you go for it.
Yeah, so not a problem. So first of all, COVID doesn't cause cancer. So we can take that off the board as far as we know. And there's no indication that that the COVID-19 virus has any implications in terms of causing cancer. There is, however, a vaccine against human papillomavirus, HPV, which causes multiple cancers, head and neck cancers, for instance, as well as cervix cancer especially. And HPV vaccination can stop that disease, can stop that group of diseases that's caused by human papillomavirus. So that is a tremendous breakthrough. Just think about it. You can get a vaccine that will prevent someone from getting cervix cancer and head and neck cancer. That's a tremendous, tremendous observation, and it's a tremendous accomplishment by scientists who've done work in the field of virology. So we're very proud of the fact that we do have an HPV vaccine, and the American Cancer Society has promoted that vaccination because we know that it can stop people from developing a cancer. So you can get a shot now and look forward to a cancer-free existence from the point of view of head and neck cancers, as well as cervix cancers, both of which are linked to HPV infection. The other part of your question actually is also interesting, because the process by which we make the messenger RNA vaccine for COVID is going to be a process that can be looked at in terms of cancer prevention. So we can possibly adapt those same techniques that we use to make the messenger RNA vaccines for COVID to creating vaccines against cancer. That is some research that will be looked at very heavily in the years to come. It turns out that there is a vaccine that's going to be used and going to human trial for breast cancer. And that vaccine is going to go into human trials this year at the Cleveland Clinic, a first-time vaccine against breast cancer. So stay tuned. That will be some very interesting news coming down the road. I happen to be involved, for full disclosure, with that company that is created that vaccine and is involved in the first human trials for a breast cancer vaccine at the Cleveland Clinic. So vaccines and cancer are going to be a new way of trying to control the disease. And some of that research that has made it possible to create the COVID vaccine will be used to try to look at vaccines in various types of cancers. So your question is very, very apropos the time that we're in right now.
It has to be an exciting time for a virologist, with so many innovative and new approaches being made. If you're just joining us, this is Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, surgeon, researcher, Dr. Arnold Baskies. He is the chair of the Global Cancer Control Advisory Council and past chairman of the National Board of Directors for our American Cancer Society. And if you'd like more information about the work that they do, its mission, if you want to make a donation, the place to go, cancer.org, cancer.org. So we've already mentioned that we're being slack on our screenings. We're not going to see our doctors the way we should be going. We're not paying attention to our bodies. Are we also going to be affected by just our pandemic behavior? We're not eating right. We're not. A lot of us have stopped exercising. Is that going to have an impact on your work in the coming years?
Well, you know, you bring up a very, very interesting question, and the answer is yes. We know that healthy lifestyles, exercise, and eating right can decrease the risk of developing cancer. And there's a thing about COVID-19 stands for actually for gaining 19 pounds during the COVID epidemic, and that probably is going to be true as we started to adopt a less healthy lifestyle as a nation. We'll probably see more obesity, and we know that obesity and weight gain is directly related to cancer risk, especially in breast cancer, for instance. We know that a 20-pound weight gain a 20-pound weight loss in postmenopausal women can translate to a 60% risk decline, a decreased risk in developing breast cancer. So a 20-pound weight loss can lead to a 60% decrease in the risk of developing breast cancer. We also know that the risk of recurrence is higher in women that are carrying more weight. So imagine we now superimpose those statistics with the fact that people are exercising less and eating more during a COVID epidemic and not exercising especially. And so the caloric effect has a direct effect on cancer incidence increasing. So we're very concerned about that also. And that this is the secondary effects, if you will, of COVID infection. People not exercising and eating a less healthy diet. So those are definite concerns. Can we do something about it? Well, we can get the message out like you're doing this morning that exercise is very important, especially during a time when you're not outside and possibly doing less in terms of going to the gym, for instance, those types of things. So it's very important that we recognize that also. But cancer risk is definitely associated with weight gain and lack of exercise. So COVID has a secondary effect on that because our habits change and have changed because of COVID. So great question. I mean, it's something that we're very concerned about.
You commented that early on, you know, you're seeing 25% decline in deaths over the last, 25 years?
It's about a 26 to 27% decline over the last 25 years. So say 25 to 25, just around numbers, yes.
So that's overall. That includes
right.
that more women are surviving breast cancer. Long-term survival rates are going up there. But are we doing worse in other areas? Are other cancers now claiming first place in risk and mortality for us?
So if you look at the numbers that we've seen, the what's been driving the decrease in deaths, and the main driver of that, believe it or not, is decreased use of combustible tobacco. The main driver of that 25%, 27% decline in deaths is because people were smoking less. That's what's driven most of that decline. Yes, we've seen improvements in terms of chemotherapy for breast cancer. We've seen improvements in terms of screening, et cetera. But at the end of the day, the main driver of the improvement in numbers has been combustible tobacco. So the question is, are people smoking less or smoking more? And the answer is they're smoking more now because of the stress. More people are smoking, they're smoking more, and more people are smoking. So there will be an effect from that, unfortunately, because we know that tobacco causes lung cancer, and as well as heart disease and COPD. So the benefit that we've seen from all of the anti-tobacco legislation and in terms of the awareness that people have that smoking is related to lung cancer has been to some degree negated by this epidemic that we're facing. The stress of fear, of isolation, the effects of isolation, et cetera, et cetera. If you were a smoker, those types of things don't make it less likely that you're going to smoke. It increases the percentage of people that smoke. So we were looking at if you look at the number of people that were smoking in the United States, it was probably around 16% overall. And those numbers, we've already seen that those click up to some degree, to a small degree already. When the smoke clears, we'll see what those numbers look like. But that does not bode well for the future.
We've also introduced the entertainment of smoking, vaping, and products like that.
Right. Well, vaping, by the way, there are a number of carcinogens in the vapor that people are taking in. It doesn't matter what you're vaping, there are chemicals in the vaping process that are harmful to the lung directly and are carcinogenic. So although vaping can be a way to stop the use of combustible smoking, it isn't a get-out-of-jail-free pass. So there are some benefits from it, yes, because you can get rid of the tobacco part of the process. But at the same time, there are a number of chemicals in the vaping solutions that are particularly harmful, and we don't like it in children. So the vaping is a whole other area of concern that we have, but combustible tobacco is number one on the list.
So we're looking at some lung cancer. What about colorectal cancer? Obviously, it's top of mind now, especially in awards seasons, because of the actor Chadwick Boseman, who died at a relatively young age, 43, of colon cancer.
Colon cancer is kind of an interesting story from a number of points of view. Believe it or not, it is a public health success story. If you look at the cure rates for colorectal cancer, they've gone up. although the number of people that are younger has gone up also. So screening is a great story for colorectal cancer, but the improvements in colorectal cancer are not completely explainable by screening. Although screening is very, very important and we want to see more people screened, there's something else that's gone on that we don't understand that's been responsible for colorectal cancer improvements. Colorectal cancer is definitely a disease of awareness. We need to make sure that people get screened beginning at age 45. We've lowered that number for a whole bunch of reasons. But at the end of the day, it's very important that people get screened. But the improvements in colorectal cancer that we've seen, which is a great public health story, is not all due to screening. We just don't know why people have done generally have done better. There are individual cases like the actor that you just mentioned, and there's a baseball player who's playing for the Orioles, who at a very young age, I think he was in his 30s, developed colorectal cancer. So we are seeing it in younger people. We don't understand why, but nevertheless, we should celebrate the fact that we have a great screening tool for it, but the improvements in colorectal cancer cannot all be attributed to screening alone.
You know, we are down to our final minutes. Let's very quickly now talk about how we get involved with the American Cancer Society for volunteering, donations. How do we interface with you? How do we interact with you?
Well, the first thing is recognize that if you want to do something meaningful in the world of cancer, there's no better organization to get involved with than your American Cancer Society. We have a very, very welcoming website called cancer.org. Just go online, and there's all kinds of opportunities that you can get involved with. Everything from Real Men Wear Pink to Relay for Life. We have a potpourri, if you will, of projects that people can get involved with. We have a do-it-yourself fundraising opportunity also platform. We have a program called Researchers, which promotes cancer research opportunities for women. We're a very diverse, ethnically diverse organization. We welcome anyone who wants to be part of this great cancer fighting organization that's been around for over 100 years. And at the end of the day, all you need to do is to go to cancer.org you can become a volunteer and join the other 2 million people who are out there that are working every day and night, to end this disease.
What are your final words of advice to us? Because obviously the best way to survive cancer is to prevent it, and barring that, find it early. What do you want us to take away from this?
Don't smoke. If you do smoke, stop. Very important, number one. Number two, we have screening guidelines for colorectal cancer, and it's very important that you abide by those. We have screening programs for breast cancer. Very important. Abide by those. Try to lead as healthy a lifestyle as you possibly can. Lose weight. Don't smoke. And if you abide by those things, you have a much better chance of not developing the disease, but getting screened at a point, hopefully, where it can make a difference.
And the fundraising and the ways to donate and get involved, it sounds like whatever your interests, whatever you like to do, walking, schmoozing, and socializing, there is a place for you as a volunteer with the American Cancer Society.
I couldn't have put it better myself, to be honest with you.
So for all of those, we go to the American Cancer Society's website, and it is a great website. It has everything that you just alluded to. It's cancer.org. That's cancer.org for the American Cancer Society. My guest today, Dr. Arnold Baskies. He is a researcher, a surgeon. He is chair of the Global Cancer Control Advisory Council and past chairman of the National Board of Directors for the American Cancer Society. And to find your American Cancer Society, again, go to cancer.org. cancer.org. Dr. Baskies, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Laura, and I hope that everyone gets vaccinated as quickly as they can, please.
Amen to that. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Philadelphia Focus.